We are so lucky to have such a diversity, I should say, of wildlife here in Wisconsin. Some of them are here the year round, some leave for winter, and some only show up when it's cold and snowy outside. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. There's something to watch for and marvel at, I think, in every season of the year, isn't there? And although it might surprise you, winter is no exception to that rule. David Drake can talk about it. He's a wildlife specialist with UW Extension and associate professor of forest and wildlife ecology. David, good to see you again.
Good to see you, Larry.
Thank you very much.
And Jamie Nack, it's great to see you too.
Hey, it's wonderful to be here on such a beautiful day.
I should turn your microphones on. And then it works so much better when the microphones are on. Jamie's a wildlife outreach specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. And of course, it's always great to have you.
Yeah, great to be here.
And again, yet again, the Upper Midwest has been treated to a wonderful influx of snowy owls. Are they still around?
Yeah, they sure are, and they're around in just almost record numbers. So the last count, there was 271 of them in the state of Wisconsin, and that is just a banner year for them, and I think it's a great opportunity for a lot of people to go out and see them, and there's a lot of information out. It's been publicized pretty widely throughout the state, and there's some wonderful maps. If you go to ebird.com, you can, in the search engine for species, you can type in snowy owl. And you can see these phenomenal maps about all the locations people have been seeing them and reporting them. And you'll see red dots and you'll see blue dots in that map. And red dots are within the last 30 days, and blue dots are in 30 days or longer. But if you click on the dot in an area maybe near you, it'll tell you the day they saw them, the time they saw them, where they saw them, who saw them. And you can go out and view them for yourself. And snowy owls are a wonderful species to see. They're obviously all white with some black mottling or spotting on them. But one of the things that's a little bit different than most of the owls we're used to seeing here in Wisconsin is that the snowy owls can be active and seen during the day. And they're also more of an open land species. So a lot of our owls are primarily nocturnal, and they're associated with forested areas. And it's a little bit difficult to see sometimes, but these snowy owls are prominently featured on tops of telephone poles or silos or fence posts and, right off the roadway. So it's a neat opportunity.
I've got a great photo, a very large one, Tom Mangelson, one of the great wildlife photographers, took of a snowy owl on a barn roof and an old barn roof and an old barn and against that blue sky.
Yep.
It's just absolutely gorgeous to see.
Yep. And they're a pretty big bird, too, so they're hard to miss once you start looking for them.
And one of the really exciting developments is that some of the snowies are being tracked by GPS transmitters that they've been fitted with.
Yeah, so GPS and what they call GMS. So in the wildlife world, when we were doing research on wildlife or we want to find out more about the kind of movement and patterns and activity patterns of wildlife, we will sometimes catch an animal or a number of animals in that population and put a radio on them. And there's a bunch of different ways to affix the radio to the body, depending on what the animal is. And then we can track them. The old way was using a VHF antenna, and you'd have a handheld receiver. And just like you turn in or tune in, 90.9 to pick up Wisconsin Public Radio and your radio dial in your vehicle, you would tune in the specific frequency for the radio. But that would require you to be out there every single time that you want to find the animal with your VHF antenna. But then the advancement was GPS or geographical positioning system locators, and so you put the radio on there, and then that signal, wherever that animal is, bounces off the satellites and bounces right into your computer.
And now that is really cool.
That's a pretty neat one. So now what they're using is they've got GPS and what's called GMS radios that are solar-powered on these snowy owls, and it can both bounce off the satellite, but also uses the cell phone network across the country. And so anytime that animal comes within range of a cell phone tower, the data gets downloaded to either somebody's phone or their computer. And if the animal's not within range of a cell phone tower, it can, I think, record up to 100,000 data observations. And then as soon as it comes within range, it will download however many have been stored.
Works it all out.
Yeah, so it works all the time. And so you can go to, it's called Project Snowstorm. And in the state of Wisconsin, we've got three snowy owls with one of those radios on it. One of the snowy owls is in Buena Vista Marsh up by Stevens Point. One's at Freedom, Wisconsin, and one is in Kewaunee out near Lake Michigan. And then if you Google Project Snowstorm, you can read more about this, and you can see that they've got owls out in the East Coast as well as the Great Lakes area radioed.
Well, you know, I'm sure people are saying, well, how the heck do you catch them to get them hooked up to this transmitter?
Yeah, and there's some neat ways you can do it. So there's a couple of different trapping methods, but and I'm not specifically sure how they've caught the snowy owls. But a lot of times the raptors, you can either use what's called a bow net, and so you would put some kind of a bait, like either a rat or a rodent or a pigeon, in a kind of a steel chicken wire trap for bait, and then when the owl comes to attack that, it hits a trigger, and then the bow net will essentially shoot over the top of the owl and catch it. But there's also it's called a Belk tree or BC trap, and essentially what that is it's a kind of a box made out of chicken wire that's got an animal inside of it that the owl can't get. And then they've got numerous loops of fishing line, mm-hmm. with little tiny nooses. So when the animal goes, the owl or the raptor goes to attack the animal in the Belk tree trap, its talons entangle that fishing line, and because then that trap is heavy, it can't fly. And so you go out, and then you catch the bird. So I'm not sure specifically how they're trapping the snowy owls, but it's most likely one of those two methods.
But I am sure people are saying, well, don't the owls get hurt or a lot of them get injured? And but you're both shaking your head no.
Yeah, when they deploy those traps, the observers, especially with those Belk tree, they're staying really close. They often will just drive down the road a little ways and with a set of binoculars watch that trap.
Oh, okay.
And you're deploying it as you see. I've actually been along when we've caught some kestrels, and you just look for the bird. You know, it gets pitched out of the car into the ditch, and you drive down the road and wait, and it doesn't take too long for that bird to key in on that movement and get on there. And then you can very quickly get there and cover the animal and get it to calm down and do what you're going to do, whether it's banding it or putting a collar on it.
Yeah, and first and foremost, obviously, if you're trying to put a radio on the animal, you want that animal to be in good health and survive so you can track that animal around. And there's no benefit you to harm the animal or kill it. That's right.
Absolutely.
That's exactly right.
Well, David Drake and Jamie Knack from the UW Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and UW Extension, our guest today. And I haven't given the number. I should do that. Call us with your questions or comments. Maybe you've got some interesting sightings. Maybe you've got questions about the snowy owl or other wildlife. Call us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Carol emailed and wondered if it's true that only young owls migrate.
Oh, that's a good question. I would say no to that. Adults can be seen as well. It kind of depends on why they're here in a given year. So the snowy owl eruption, as they're called, or owl eruptions, there's other species of owls that can move south into Wisconsin, like the northern hawk owl or the great gray owl. We've really been focusing on the snowy owls this year. But the reasons they may come south are twofold. One, either on their breeding grounds on the tundra in Canada, it's been a high lemming year. So those small mammals reproduce. There's lots of them out there. And as a result, there's lots of food. And the owls have many young. And what happens is the young snowy owls can get pushed out to go and find their own territories and their own food. And it is, in that case, it would be many of the young owls that would move south into the state. Not to be, it's possible that some adults would move in that scenario as well. The other scenario is that it's a poor lemming year and there's not enough food, and both adults and young are moving south to find food. So there's two potential reasons or causes for the eruption this year. I'm not sure that we've come to an ultimate decision on why they're here. In 2012, when we had the last eruption, it was really because there was a large quantity of lemmings on the tundra, and we did see primarily young snowy owls.
We have another email, I think, or actually Bob couldn't hang on the phone, but wanted to know what you think about coy wolves. They were on the nature program a few weeks ago. So somebody's going to say, well, what the heck's a coy wolf?
Yeah, so coyotes, wolves, dogs, domestic dogs, all members of the canid family, and there is some interbreeding that can occur at times between those species, although typically in their territorial nature that
they kill each other.
they kill each other. It doesn't happen, but I'm not exactly sure at what level that does or does not occur in Wisconsin, but certainly it does occur in nature, and it's just the breeding of a coyote with a wolf.
And Doesn't happen very often. And
I don't know, really. I mean, it might be more of a, you know, it probably changes depending on the density of those animals in a given area.
Yeah.
But I really can't say as far as Wisconsin goes at what frequency that happens.
And I think we have, you know, probably the more common pairing are coy dogs.
Yeah.
Coyotes with a domestic dog.
Correct.
Yeah, that makes more sense to me. John from Richland Center wondered about salamanders. He says, it's been 40 years since I've seen one.
Well,
you haven't been looking well
enough.
Yeah,
I was going to say, John, that's a dang gum good question. Why it's been 40 years you haven't seen one? Because they're in Wisconsin, and we've got a good variety of salamanders. Most of them are aquatic to some regard, and obviously salamanders are amphibians, so that they need wetland habitats in the spring and summer to breed, and then they need the upland habitat in the wintertime to hibernate. And they'll hibernate under the duff layer, or if the soil's organic, they'll kind of wiggle their way deep into the soil so that they can avoid the extreme cold temperature during the wintertime. And so we do have a variety of salamanders in the state of Wisconsin here. The largest is the mud puppy. And then we've got some salamanders up north that are primarily terrestrial, like the redback salamander and things like that. But I live out in western Middleton, out by Shoveler's Sink, which is a big waterfowl production area. And when we get the first warm rain this springtime, which eventually spring is coming, that we will get tiger salamanders that will start moving from the upland habitat. And if you're familiar with West Middleton, Timber Lane Road out there,
you get tons of them.
We will have hundreds. And so my kids and I, when we first moved here about 8.5 years ago, we went out for the first time we saw it. And I think my kids bucketed about 150 across the road in an hour.
Wow.
And so it's really neat to see them. And they are salamanders as a group of animals are kind of struggling a little bit for survival because they again, need that wetland habitat to be adjacent to upland habitats, and when you create roadways or human development, it breaks that connection of habitat up. And they also interact. You know, they use their skin is moist, and they transfer oxygen and water between the environment and their skin, and so they're susceptible to you know, non-point source pollutants in the soil or toxins in the water and things like that. But
yeah,
they're a wonderful, wonderful group of animals that we have in Wisconsin.
And again, you can join in with your questions and comments. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Todd in Delavan emailed us, for the first time since we built our house 8 years ago, we have turkeys at our feeders. It started with just a few, but now there are 12 to 15, 3 to 4 times a day. At first it was cool, but now I find myself scaring them off to save the seed I put out for the other birds. Obviously, they're having a hard winter, but my question is, will they go on their way once the snow melts, or will they continue eating the easy food?
Well, Todd, at this time of the year, turkeys are in flocks, so there's a number of birds in the flock. Come spring, which is the breeding season for turkeys, they'll disperse into hen groups, and then the toms and the jakes will often disperse even further and be more solitary or in small bachelor groups. So, you know, at this point, you might want to start elevating that bird seed to prevent them from coming in, because it's still, I mean, we still have a ways to go here before the natural foods are available on the landscape, and it has been a long winter. So you might want to elevate your bird feeders or feed them in a different, if you're using a platform feeder, maybe go to a enclosed feeder and get those elevated to prevent them from coming in so they don't get too habituated to that area and get them dispersed. And come spring, you know, it's hard to say. If you take that tactic now, yes, I think they would move on. And as I said, they're going to split up and look for more natural foods and try to avoid people with the hunting season starting in April. Typically, they figure that out pretty quickly and shy away from people.
Talking today about the wonderful world of wildlife with David Drake and Jamie Knack, I'm Larry Mueller. Rob and Cherry are on-air producer today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guests, wildlife experts David Drake and Jamie Knack. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Certainly love to hear from you. Dan in Sheboygan up next. Dan, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I just thought I'd tell you. Our the only is the mounted or dead white owl, is that still illegal? The reason why I ask is about 40 years ago, I hit one with the car, and I brought it home, and I stuck it in the freezer for mounting eventually. And then I talked to a DNR guy, and he says, you better bring that to our office because you could get fined for owning one.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, Jamie?
Yeah, the way the regulations read, unless you have a hunting or trapping license for the animal, that is roadkilled. So either you kill the animal or you come across roadkill, you don't have a license basically to possess the animal. So if you come across something that you're interested in, you need to call a conservation officer and get that permission. Sometimes for educational purposes, they'll issue you a permit. You may have to pay something for it, but allows you to possess that animal. So you really have to have some form of license or permit to be in possession of that. And you can probably understand where that comes from is,
sure.
You know, birds, especially snowy owls, are federally protected. The question is, you know, how did you come into possession of that? So
very good points. Thanks a lot, Dan, for calling. I appreciate your call. John in Mineral Point. Hi, John. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. A few years ago back, we had a lot of rabbit damage when we had a heavy winter. And so to kind of keep the rabbits away, we put some feeding stations at either end of our property that were covered with rabbit pellets. And all rabbits go to those now instead of our bushes. And I'm wondering if there's anything we can do for to keep the deer away, too, like put a bale of alfalfa back or if that's legal.
Okay, there's we wanted to talk about feeding deer today, so you have the perfect call here, John. Thank you.
Great.
Yeah, thanks, John. That's a great lead-in to an important conversation I wanted to have today on the phone. So, or over the phone, over the radio here. So in terms of helping deer through the winter, and there is a lot of concern, the DNR is paying very close attention to this winter's impacts on the deer herd. They're encouraging you to report any observations of deer mortality in your area, and that is not just now, but in the coming months, because the winter's not over. It's actually February, March, early April that are going to be the hardest parts because they've lost so much of their body reserves. So in terms of laws and regulations for deer feeding, there are over 30 counties in the state where you may not feed or bait, but in this case we're talking about feeding, where you may not feed deer, and that is because of chronic wasting disease and that threat that disease poses to the Wisconsin deer herd. So feeding deer concentrates deer and facilitates the spread of diseases, and in those counties where CWD has been detected in wild or captive deer, there is a ban on feeding. So
Mineral Point is...
It would be within that ban.
Yep. Yep.
So that doesn't mean that you can't feed squirrels, that you can't feed birds, but you have to do so in a manner that places that feed out of reach of deer. So you have to elevate it. You can't feed on the ground. Okay, so that's kind of where we're at for, the regulation aspect. Other than that, in counties where there is no ban, primarily in the north, there are regulations on quantities of feed that can be placed and where it can be placed. And I'll just mention a few, but there are more to it. But in quantities of, you can't feed in quantities of more than 2 gallons, and you can't feed more than 50 yards away from an owner-occupied residence. So in terms of wanting to help the deer herd, you have to keep in mind the laws and regulations would keep that feed very close to a dwelling. That could cause additional impacts on ornamental trees and shrubs in the yard.
Yeah.
But if we talk just in terms of biology and whether feeding deer is a good idea from the science side of it and the biology and the population level of deer in the state and in the country, it is probably not a good idea. And the reason being, deer are really adapted to survive winter. In winters like this, we would expect some mortality, and it's typically the young deer or the older deer that haven't had the opportunity or didn't put on enough fat reserves by summer and into early fall. So it depends really largely on the animal's physical health going into the winter, the severity and the duration of the winter, and the amount of quality food available, and the amount of energy it uses, whether that animal is going to make it through. It's been shown that even putting out feeding food, like emergency feeding that a state agency may do, it may only reach 20% of that local population of deer because some of them aren't going to come come in and feed to begin with. And I guess the other thing, one thing to make sure everybody's aware of, you don't want to feed 100% corn and you don't want to feed 100% hay. Their bodies aren't in a position at this time of the year to be able to handle that. And they end up filling up with hay and they can't process it and they can have mortality just because that's not the proper food rations to be giving them. So, and a thing you could do if you own property and you're concerned about them is to drop a few hardwood trees, cut a few maples on the property, and they would use that natural browse then as a suitable source of food to help them through a little bit longer. That's an acceptable way to, you know, to feed deer. If you still would like to do something supplementally, really encourage you to call the local wildlife biologist, talk through the rules, regulations, and recommendations. There are different formulations and pellets that can be fed, but again, I think overall, as a wildlife biologist looking at that, it's probably not in the best interest of the deer.
Now, in John's case, he's probably also saying, well, if I can't get him away from my plants with feed,
John, some other suggestions right now to deal with deer in the backyard is scare them off every time you can. Don't sit and, you know, watch them and enjoy them being in your backyard. Scare them. You can mechanically protect some of the trees and shrubs, ornamentals that you'd like to by covering them loosely with burlap or any of the mechanical fencing materials. Put up a snow fence around some of the arborvitae or whatever it might be that they're getting on. And you can also try looking at a local garden center or hardware store for repellents that are specifically designed to be used during the dormant season and applying those to the plants.
So a few things to consider there. And, John, thank you so much for calling.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. We have Adrian in Ashland next. Adrian, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry, Jamie, and Dave.
Hi, Adrian.
Hey, thanks for calling, Adrian.
Yeah, thanks for setting us straight.
I wanted to give a little more of an explanation on the Kai wolves because we get a lot of questions about that.
Yeah.
We have never detected direct breeding of wolves with coyotes in Wisconsin, but there are coyotes in eastern U.S. that are sometimes referred to as Kai wolves. And the reason for that is when coyotes from the Midwest region start dispersing into the Northeast, going through the UP and through southern Ontario, they start meeting up with a smaller race or smaller species of wolf in Ontario known as the eastern wolf. And coyotes do readily interbreed with those smaller eastern wolves, and then the coyotes continue to spread eastward from that area, carry those eastern wolf genes with them into New England. So as you get into New England, most of those coyotes do have some of those small eastern wolf genes with them.
Oh.
In Wisconsin, we do have some. If you genetically look at our wolves, some of them do have some coyote genes, but they're carried into the wolf population by our gray wolves breeding with smaller eastern wolves that have some of the coyote genes with them. So it's kind of a complicated process. But in any case, we're not seeing direct breeding of wolves in the Great Lakes region with coyotes, but that had happened in Ontario, and it still happens in Ontario. And some of those coyotes then have spread eastward and carry those genes with them. And that's why the wolves or the coyotes in the Northeast are being referred to as a Kai wolf, because they are a coyote that has some eastern wolf genes with them.
Oh, Adrian.
Adrian, thank you very much. Yeah. We should also say this is Adrian Weideman with the DNR. And I guess, Adrian, your new title for the last year or so has been forest wildlife ecologist, but you were the wolf biologist or wolf ecologist for the DNR for a long, long time. So Adrian would be the authority on this.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. I'm going to get him back to talk about wolves again sometime. or his other work as well. He's been a guest on the show quite a few times.
He's wonderful.
Yeah, a wonderful guy. Linda and Spooner, your turn. Hi, Linda.
Hi. Say, I don't know if the laws have changed over the last few years, but I did tumble across an owl. It wasn't a snowy, and it wasn't a heart-shaped, real pretty-faced owl. It was just a speckled owl. And I put it in the freezer, too, because I was going to do something with the wings to make a fan. And I did go to the DNR with it, and they said, no way, no way on God's green earth can you have an owl or any bird of prey, even with paperwork. And I asked if they would stuff it and donate it to an elementary school, and they just said, we'll take care of it. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Well, thank you very much for the story, Linda. A lot of times owls, and in particular, you know, great horned owls and barred owls and things like that, will get hit on the roads by cars because they are hunting or they're perched in trees above the road, and as their prey, you know, rodent or a rabbit or whatever crosses the road, they'll go down and ambush it and kill it. And then they'll sit on the road, and they might start to eat that animal. And as they're doing that, they're not paying attention, obviously, that they're on a road with cars traveling. And so sometimes they will get hit by vehicles on the road, and it's quite common to find owls dead along the side of the road. And as Jamie alluded to a couple of callers ago, one of the reasons that they do not allow you to keep raptors in particular as a larger group of birds, including owls, eagles, hawks, things like that, is for a while those animals years ago were persecuted because they would kill chickens and other livestock. And so if you had one in your possession, did you kill it illegally, and is that how you came to possess it, or did you find it alongside the road as a consequence of car vehicle collision? So it's hard for the authorities to know that, and they're also trying to protect the raptors. And some of the raptors are federally protected under, for example, the Bald and Golden Eagle Federal Act. Others are migratory, and they're protected under a different federal law and things like that. So it's for the animal's own good use. And a lot of times what the DNR will do is they will confiscate the animal, and they'll taxidermically mount it, and then they will donate it to a nature center or to a school or something like that with the proper permitting so that they can use it for educational purposes.
There we go, Linda. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. And I want to give Bob and Krivitz a chance to join in. Bob, hello.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
Well, I heard you talking about the turkeys and being a problem with feeders, and I wonder if you ever ran across this. Have you ever used a squirrel feeder, a homemade squirrel feeder, where you take a one-gallon jug and you lay it on its side and it feeds into a box and the squirrels come in from either side? Have you ever seen those?
I've seen those, yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. We feed birds in our yard. I'm right across from, in south of Sheboygan, across from Terry Andrew Park in the wildlife reference. So we feed a lot of birds. It usually takes 5 gallons of sunflower seed to fill all our feeders. But anyhow, we raised all our feeders, so we had about 20 turkeys coming in. We raised them all, okay, and this squirrel feeder is about 6 feet off the ground. And one day my mother-in-law, who lives with us, she's handicapped, was sitting out in the sunroom watching this, and this turkey flew in and landed and stood on top of that jar, the jar laying sideways, a one-gallon jar with snow on it. He fell off about 5-6 times. Finally got back on there again, and he's balancing on his jar, and he sees the corn in the jar, but he can't figure out how to get it out. The second day he comes in, and I got a picture of this. He stands on the glass jar. First he tried the roof of the little feeder and tried to stick his head in there. That didn't work. So then he stood on the glass jar again, and he figured out how to work his head around the inside from balancing on that glass jar. And you can imagine how slippery that is with snow and claws. And he's working it perfect. He does it every day.
Wow. Well, hey, can you post one of those on my Facebook page?
Sure can.
Oh, that'd be wonderful. I would love to see that.
Yeah, they're Bob. Pretty tenacious. It's been a rough year, and turkeys obviously can fly short distances, and it's not much different than trying to keep squirrels off of your feeders. If they want in, they will be pretty.
Yeah, yep. go to the Facebook, go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page and post it, and I would love to see it. Yep. Thanks, Bob.
Food's a pretty strong motivator, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, the one thing we maybe should mention quickly about feeding corn, especially with turkeys, is they are sometimes susceptible to what's called aflatoxins, and the corn will kind of mold and it'll toxify. And if you start seeing dead turkeys in your area and you know that corn is being fed, get the corn off the landscape and maybe go back to the feed supplier that's providing the corn and have them test it for aflatoxin. And if they do find it in their supply, get that supply off the market and you know, make sure you do stop feeding that corn, because that can be a deadly thing. And as Jamie again alluded to with the deer issue, is sometimes you know, we have the best of intentions for wildlife, but sometimes our best intentions are detrimental to the animals, and we actually do more harm than we do good.
KC in Fort Wayne, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Great, appreciate your call.
Okay, let's talk about northwestern Wisconsin, i.e. Douglas County, Bayfield County, Ashland County, where the snow is really deep this year, and the deer probably are struggling, but their real main concern is trying to survive the timberwolf population, because the timberwolves are doing a lot more than the snow is. So on that note, I would also like to remind people that when they feed the birds, especially in the country where there is deer, the deer really don't know the difference between a bird feeder and a deer feeder. And most deer eat out of bird feeders, and they're not, just not smart enough to know the difference that, hey, this is for birds, not deer. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, I think the other point I'd like to make, too, which with the notion of supplemental feeding, not just concerns over disease spread, but there's also been some concerns at least talked about. And if you concentrate deer in the north, would the wolves, you know, key in on that too and also cause a situation where they're, you know, more vulnerable to that predation as well? But I think, you know, based on the last call, you know, the goal here is to elevate your feeders and make them unavailable to deer.
Well, I think the type of feeder too. So sunflower seed feeders certainly are susceptible to deer, you know, sticking their tongue in there and licking those seeds out of there. But thistle or tube feeders are a lot more difficult for deer to get the food out, and but certain types of birds can still eat that thistle. Now, obviously, you're excluding big birds like jays and robins, jays and cardinals and things like that. But, you know, one thing maybe we could talk a little bit about either today or another show is we're, you know, we started getting into this gray area between feeding or baiting versus establishing food plots. And sometimes people don't always see the difference in that, but there are marked differences. And if you are concerned about doing something good for wildlife, especially the larger animals that range across a wider part of the landscape, like deer and turkey and things like that, you know, establishing food plots are a lot healthier for deer than putting out bait piles. And they're a lot more sustainable. So that's something maybe we can talk a little bit about at some point.
Well, just focusing on native plants and trees and shrubs and those plantings in general, and good forest management, harvesting timber is a better long-term habitat management and probably easier on the pocketbook than some of those things.
For sure.
For sure. Well, we have some open lines. You can get in pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. Let's turn to Bud next in Taylor. Bud, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi. Say, I was wondering if your guests could talk a little bit about what's going on with the moose herd in northern Minnesota. They say since 2010, we've lost about half.
Yeah, I just saw a report on the news this morning, the morning newscast, about that situation. You guys know anything about it, David, or...
I'm not familiar enough to speak intelligently on that. So I'm going to have to pass on this. And maybe, Larry, we can put something up. And, you know, Jamie and I can go back and look into this a little bit and check with the Minnesota DNR and maybe respond through your Facebook page.
That would be great if you could, because I was going to ask that question myself, because I saw the report on the CBS News this morning, and I thought, that's something
we
need to talk
about. Yeah, we can
certainly
do that.
All right, so I'll tell you what, Bud... pay attention to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and we'll try to get we'll get something up. Jamie and David will get something up for you.
And maybe we can look into it on the break too, and come back after break.
Yep. Kathy near Chippewa Falls saw a robin in a tree this morning after dropping off her daughter at school. She had to get pushed out of a snowbank when she pulled too far off the road, but it was worth it. And Tom. Johnson, I believe, sent a photo of a robin in a tree. We have that up on my Facebook page.
Yep. So, Kathy, you sound like a passionate birder. So, I understand where you're coming from, and I would be willing to go into a snowbank to see a bird myself. So, so robins are back, and you know, obviously, robins sometimes can winter through. Our area here in Wisconsin throughout the entire year, throughout the entire winter. Sometimes they go south. Sometimes we get some of the robins that come down from Canada, you know, but we are starting to get the robins returning, and I think they're most likely from the ones that migrated south are starting to come back. They're one of the earlier migrants returning, along with cedar waxwings, and cedar waxwings have also been reported here in Wisconsin now. So spring is coming. Hang on.
Absolutely.
And that's a good indication.
I go out every morning and do 5K or about a 3-mile And boy, the bird songs have really increased.
Yep, they
especially
sure have.
This morning. It was very noticeable.
Yeah, it was really noticeable. I had listening. I had a cardinal. It was going on and on, and I thought, oh man,
it's amazing.
It is coming. It is.
It
coming.
Is. That's right. You know, a sunny day above 32 buoys everybody's spirits, humans and wildlife.
Yep, there you go, Terry in Fond du Lac. Hi, thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. The robins are back. I rescued a couple of them that got in behind one of my wheel well covers. They're using it like a solar home on the west side of the house, but they're safely both got out. But my comment has to do with the bird feeders. I've seen several pictures where no matter what style of bird feeder that you adhere to, whether chickadees, thistles, you know, sunflower seeds, the spoils get knocked out at no matter what the height is of the feeder, and the deer will still come in and eat the spoils on the ground.
Yeah, absolutely, Terry. It's not perfect. It's hopefully to help minimize how accessible, how much food they're getting. The recommendation, like for instance, platform feeders with no sides to them, they tend, you know, birds get in there, start scratching around, throwing seeds around. You're going to have more spillage onto the ground with those types of feeders. So, you know, selecting a feeder that's contained can reduce that. Going out there and removing once there's a concentration of seed, getting that out of there. And another thing I've seen people do, especially now, my parents pulled in some feeders because they were having deer visiting and really didn't want them to get onto their landscape plants because they lost about 20 plants last year and really couldn't afford to have that happen again. So another strategy some folks will do is actually pull your feeders in at night and then put them out during the day. And obviously that involves some labor, but it's at the cost of, or, you know, it's at the expense of hopefully not attracting deer to the backyard where they might focus on unwanted plants and trees.
Yeah.
So it's not perfect. We can't clean up every seed, but we try to reduce how much is available.
So, and I'm sympathetic to the issue with deer and attracting deer in with the food and things of that nature. But keep in mind, as those seeds drop, you're also benefiting a variety of other wildlife. So we've got birds that feed only on the ground or primarily on the ground, such as mourning doves. And so as those seeds drop, if you don't have a ground feeder, it provides food for them. And we've watched in our own yard as the seeds drop that we have meadow voles that poke their head up through the snow, grab the seed off the snow, and then poke their head back down and go about their business. So it can be frustrating with those deer coming in, but keep in mind that those seeds also benefit a wide variety of wildlife.
And thanks again for calling. Our guests today, wildlife specialists David Drake and Jamie Knack. I'm Larry Mueller. Michelle Good, our on-air producer now, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with David Drake and Jamie Knack. Jamie's an outreach specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. And David is a wildlife specialist with UW Extension, associate professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison. Great to have them along. Thank you for listening in. And I want to go back to the moose for a minute. You had a chance to go to your smartphone.
Yep, I went to my computer with a phone attached to it and pulled up something about the Minnesota moose study. So it turns out the Minnesota DNR is looking into the problem, and it looks like they've collared at least 36 moose with these high-tech GPS collars. So as the moose move around, the signal bounces off the satellites in space and bounces down to somebody's computer, and then they can analyze the data. And it looks like they're gonna capture 50 newborn moose calves and put collars on those 50 as well. And this is going to be it looks like a long-term 7-year study, and they're into the first year of that 7-year study. And apparently since 2010, the moose population in Minnesota has declined by 52%. So that's a pretty precipitous drop in, you know, roughly 3 or 4 year period. And the DNR said, you know, obviously they said they're in the first year of the study. They know why individual moose have died, for example, from predation or disease or something like that. But they are too early into the study to know exactly why or even to begin to hypothesize why the population has taken a 52% nosedive. So stay tuned. Thank you very much for bringing that to our attention, and maybe we will update this story as it goes along.
I was thinking back to a time when my wife and I were, with a large group. It was a business group in Grand Marais, and so there was the opportunity to go hiking to possibly see a moose, and so my wife and I were the only two of the bunch that volunteered, because it was a lot of heavy walking and hiking.
Yeah.
And we get back. We didn't see anything. We get back, and the rest said, oh, we were on the bus.
Oh, no.
And there was a big bull moose right next to the road.
Yeah. When I was growing up, we would go to the Boundary Waters in Quetico every single year, and I have vivid memories of seeing them, you know, wading into the water with calves and bull moose and the cow moose and things like that. And they are a very, very large, impressive animal. Yep.
John in Green Bay. Hi, thank you for calling.
Well, hate to bring up squirrels, but I am no fan of squirrels. And I have never had a squirrel in 13 years on my feeder. But I do have sympathy for animals that are injured. And two or three times a year, have a squirrel show up, like this one caught my attention here a couple of weeks ago. He fell out of the tree, and they can't stand up. They keep rolling over. I was just wondering what kind of a disease that is. I've seen it over the years. And squirrels, they get their feed. They worked out a deal with the birds who kick it off the feeder to the squirrels, but they've never been on my feeder.
Hmm. So John, did you...
Because they haven't tried.
Yeah. John, did you see the squirrel fall, or you're thinking that's what happened?
Oh, no. I have been watching birds for the last 50 years, you know. I know what a squirrel looks like.
No.
I've actually seen it fall.
No.
I've seen it.
Did you
fall?
Fall.
Did you see it fall. Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's probably, if you saw it fall and after that it has the injuries, it's probably more of a physical ailment than it is a disease with that squirrel. And it's truly amazing what animals can survive and adapt, and injuries that they can recover from and go on living. I mean, we've seen squirrels with half a tails. That'd be nice to know what that story was, or deer with broken legs or three legs. And it's truly amazing what animals can endure.
I have my bird feeders. I have a couple of really expensive ones, but now I've had them for several years, but the birds can roost on them and eat. But if a squirrel gets on them, it's somehow the weight pulls it down, so they can't
counterweighted or counterbalanced.
They were expensive
hoppers. Mm-hmm. Yep. And the other nice thing, I assume yours is made out of metal.
Yeah,
is that they don't allow the squirrels to chew on them. So some of the wood ones, you know, the squirrels are gnawing on and things like that. So they're expensive, but in the long term.
Yeah, I think they were over $100 a piece. But
yeah, the larger. They make some smaller sizes that are more in the 40s, but they can be good for keeping squirrels off, because as soon as the squirrel gets on the perch, it's heavy enough to shut off the access to the food.
Yep, absolutely. John, thanks again. Appreciate it. And we'll turn to Terry in North Lake next. Terry, hi.
Hi. I have a question about bluebirds. We've had our bluebird nesting boxes up all winter, and I note that the sparrows are in and out of them and that kind of thing. So I'm wondering how to discourage the sparrows. Should I take them down for a period of time? And if I do that, when should I put the map back up for the bluebirds?
Terry, that's a good question. Thank you very much for putting up bluebird boxes. And I'm guessing a lot of people know this, but for a while, back in the 40s and 50s, bluebirds were kind of on the downswing as a population, partly because of all the insecticides that were being used. And bluebirds are primarily an insectivore. They eat insects. But they also are cavity nesters, and they would nest a lot of times in the cavities of fence posts, wooden fence posts. And as those fences are getting ripped out, the cavities were not available. And so somebody came up with the idea to try bluebird boxes, and that almost single-handedly has been the one thing that has really brought bluebirds back. And it's a wonderful activity. There's a lot of, you know, Boy Scout and Girl Scout troops and a lot of other people who make bluebird boxes, and then they put them up, and it's a great activity to involve kids of all ages to understand how wildlife ecology works. But
yeah, we've enjoyed the heck out of watching them. It's been wonderful.
Yep. Yeah, and they are just, you know, they're a beautiful bird. They're easily recognizable. Everybody likes seeing them. But to get to your question, so the best thing to do, Terry, is once the bluebirds start leaving the area, and sometimes, you know, that might be into the middle of fall, late fall, go ahead and prop open your bluebird box. And you can do that by putting some kind of a wedge in there or you know, if you can take the door off, whatever the case is. But if you can prop that open, then it does not provide enough thermal insulation inside that bluebird box for somebody to go in there and use it. And so sparrows will use it. But the other animal that's very, famous for using bluebird boxes in the winter are deer mice, and they'll go in and actually nest in your bluebird box. But if you prop the door open so that the wind and weather is constantly circulating through that open box, it does discourage animals from coming in there. And then in the springtime, you know, maybe come March 15th or so, go in there and at least sweep out your bluebird box, or maybe you want to take a light water Clorox solution and wash them out a little bit. And then, you know, seal the door up and wait for the bluebirds to come in there. And keep in mind that they do nest multiple times over the course of the year. So as you see one bluebird concluding its first clutch, perhaps clean that bluebird box out and then seal it again. And then another bluebird will use it for a second clutch and maybe even a third clutch.
Yeah.
And Terry, if
I
can...
Pretty much right now what I can do is open it up, let whatever we have remaining of bad weather do its job. And then... like you say, March 15th, give it a cleaning.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Terry, another resource for you, a really excellent resource. And I think they may even advertise March 1st. It's hard to think of March 1st, you know, right now. But anyway, the early March, time to clean up and get new bluebird houses out on the landscape. But the Bluebird Restoration Association of Wisconsin, their acronym is BRAW, B-R-A-W. They have a wonderful website and lots of science-based information, research, designs for bluebird houses, tips for where to put them up, when to put them up, how to clean them, how to identify other species besides bluebirds and their nests. It's just a wonderful website, so I'd really encourage you to check that out.
Give it
I will. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Jerry. And Jeff in Minocqua, hi to you. Thanks for calling.
Hi, guys. I have a snowy owl mount that's been in my family for probably 60, 80 years. It's just been hanging on the wall ever since I can remember. And I wanted to know about the legality of owning it and the legality of selling it. I have no paperwork on it. It's just been up on the wall ever since I was a little kid.
Well, Jeff, it is illegal for you to own that. So if you could give us your address right now, we'll have the authorities come over there as fast as they can. And it is illegal for you to possess it without the necessary permit. So, you know, the best thing to do is maybe call the DNR and ask somebody in your local warden to come out and, you know, maybe help you navigate the legalities of that.
Yeah, I think, you know, talking with your local conservation warden and explaining, you know, the situation. It's been in the family for a very, very, very long time.
They're going to understand that.
There very well may have been paperwork with it at one time. As far as selling it, that's probably not an option. But I think the opportunity to donate it to an educational facility is there, and that can certainly be a tax write-off. They can give you that, a letter for that. So, you know, if you really want to pursue it, then that's really who you need to talk to is a local conservation warden.
Yep.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate the call. And yeah, I really think, you know, when that old, a DNR person, they're going to know that it was 60, 80 years old.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's right.
So there's going to be a little more.
And each situation is different, and they'll evaluate it, sure.
And it was more common, you know, 80, 100, 120 years old ago to have mounts of animals and birds in particular in your house because, you know, John James Audubon, the way that he collected birds was over the barrel of a shotgun.
Yeah.
So it was a very common thing to have in buildings and houses.
Tom in Jackson has a question for you. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Larry, and your very interesting guest. I have two quick questions. One is, what can I do with nuisance rodents, especially squirrels, that where my garage is connected to the house, they'll actually chew through the garage and be into the house in the winter. Can I trap them and move them and release them?
I'm sorry, Tom, do you have more to your question?
Well, the other thing is you're just talking about the birds and stuff like that. What feathers can I own and not own?
Mm-hmm. All right, so we'll talk about the squirrel first then. On property that you own, squirrels are one of those what's called unprotected species. So at the time the damage is occurring, you are welcome to trap that animal if you wish. You're welcome to euthanize the animal, kill it, however you wish to handle the animal. But one thing that happens with squirrels, because they are so common, is that if you live trap it and you go someplace to release it, if you do release it on private property you don't own, that you need that property owner's permission to do so, to release the animal. So you've got a bit of an issue with do you have a place to release it legally? But the other problem is because squirrels are so common, and again, we're talking, I'm guessing we're talking about a gray squirrel or a red squirrel, but you know, the northern and southern flying squirrels in our state, that they are protected species, and you cannot treat them the same way you would treat a gray squirrel, for example. So you have to be careful of that. One of the issues with, because gray squirrels are so common, by the time you get home from releasing that animal, probably one or two or three have moved in. So it's a bit like the little boy with his finger in the dike. The better option is where they're chewing is to take some chicken wire or hardware cloth or some sheet metal and affix it over the area where they're chewing to prevent them from chewing that area. And make sure that you also don't have any thing that's trying to attract them. So you don't have any food in the garage they're trying to get into, or if you have bird seed or food, that it's in a rodent-proof metal trash can, for example. You might hang Mylar tape or try to harass them out of the area. So you stream Mylar tape off of your garage or something like that. But if you want to go to wildlifedamage.uwex.edu, we've got a fact sheet on this, and we'd also be glad to help you if you want to email or call Jamie or myself.
And the feathers, we can deal with the feathers.
After break?
We're going to take a little break. David Drake and Jamie Nack, our guests today from the University of Wisconsin and UW Extension, talking about the world of wildlife. We'll talk about what feathers you can possess and a whole lot more after we take a look at the news. Please stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of wildlife today with a couple of guests, David Drake and Jamie Nack. They are both with the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison and with UW Extension. David is as well, so it's great to have them along to talk about wildlife and to answer your wildlife questions, and I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Could email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And we had a caller who asked about feathers and what feathers he could actually possess. And we also had an email from Michael in Milwaukee who wondered about eagle feathers. And so what's the word on it, Jamie?
Yeah, so in terms of which feathers you can possess, if it's a bird that can be hunted, you can possess the feathers. And it is your license that is the permit, the license in order to be able to possess that. So in terms of birds, we're talking about turkeys and pheasants, ducks, geese. So again, if it's a bird that can be harvested and you hold a license, your license is your permit to be able to possess those feathers. And that's why we see mounts of pheasants and turkey fans and rough grouse fans and things like that. As far as the bald eagle or golden eagle, whatever type of eagle feather that was, as far as disposing of it, you can, you know, do that on your own, or you could donate it to an educational facility. That facility would need to have an education permit to possess it or a scientific collector's permit. Those are the things that we have within our Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology so that we can have lots of different specimens to be able to teach our students about the taxonomy of Wisconsin's wildlife.
Yeah.
So
we got some pretty cool. I mean,
we do.
Really,
we got
good.
A pretty neat collection.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the eagle feathers. That's actually most of these are protected through the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. But in case of bald eagle, they're additionally protected with the Bald Eagle Protection Act. So the only other potential way to possess is through the tribes through treaty rights. They can declare. And use them for ceremonial purposes. So,
you know, as long as we're on feathers and birds, there is a seminar coming up on nest boxes. That sounds really interesting.
Yeah, I just caught this yesterday. It was a press release by the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. It's the next nest box seminar offered at Horicon Marsh. It's going to occur on March 1st from 9 a.m. till 3 p.m. It's a free event. It's open to the public, and there's no registration required. Basically, it's going to be held at the Horicon Marsh Education and Visitor Center. There's going to be a variety of displays by a number of birding and bat organizations throughout the state. Local nest box enthusiasts and experts will present and share knowledge gained from years of building, mounting, and monitoring nest boxes for a variety of species. Some folks like Jack Bartholomew, the Bluebird Restoration Association of Wisconsin we mentioned earlier. Liz Herzman is the new educator there, and she is going to share stories about nest box treasures. It really looks like a fantastic event. If you'd like more information, you can look for the most recent press release on the DNR website, or go to horiconmarsh.org or horiconmarshbirdclub.com.
So there you go. That would be a lot of fun.
I think it would be fun. And they have an opportunity there to purchase and build nest boxes right on site. And again, then you have the experts to talk about placement and what to expect and when to get them out and things like that.
That's a great family activity to do with your kids.
Yeah.
Now's the time.
You know, I think nest boxes are great, a wonderful thing to use out there in the landscape as a type of habitat. So it does provide some shelter and places to raise young and things like that. But like feeding, if you do, you can do certain things with nest boxes that can be detrimental to birds or bats. And one of those things is if you paint the box with latex paint, sometimes it traps the heat in there. It can overheat the birds and stuff like that. So there are right ways and there are wrong ways to do this. And there's a lot of information out there through these workshops that Jamie just highlighted. Or if you go online to Bat Conservation International or the Bluebird Restoration Association or something like that. And if you're going to do stuff for, you know, to benefit wildlife, just make sure you're doing the correct thing so that you're not harming the wildlife at all.
Take some calls here. I think I can do it. No, I can't. As a matter of fact, we're having some phone issues right now. So I know I have some people online, but it's just for some reason I'm not able to get to you. So
well, it looks like Greg emailed in something a little while ago that he saw a bald eagle.
I wanted to go back to that.
Because he saw a bald eagle, a woodpecker.
Redheaded woodpecker.
With a redheaded woodpecker. And
some bluebirds.
Male and female bluebirds. So he said, spring is coming. Hang on. It's hopeful. So I think, bald eagles have been around even though we've had a severe winter.
Seen a lot of them this year.
They sure
I've
have
really
been.
Seen a lot.
Yep, it's and, you know, great. The Wisconsin River has been open. So that helps them to hunt. And so it's been nice to see them around. And redheaded woodpeckers are a species that has kind of, you know, fluctuated a little bit, but they seem to be on the rebound, and they are a species that's associated, historically associated with oak savannas, where you've got mostly a prairie, but dotted oak trees here and there, and one of the reasons that they seem to be coming back, and what they're using as a surrogate oak savanna are golf courses, so that's kind of a nice place. If you want to see a redheaded woodpecker, go see a golf course. And bluebirds, I'm not sure if they ever left. I know we were picking up some bluebirds during the Christmas bird count into December.
Yeah, certainly some have moved out, but others choose to stay if they have the correct composition of habitat they need.
Well, let's try the phones again here and see if we can get Beth on from Orfordville. Beth, are you there?
I am.
Hi, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Say, I've got a suggestion for an inexpensive way to keep squirrels off a bird feeder.
Okay.
This is a bird feeder that is a pole and a bird feeder. Okay.
Okay. A pole and a bird feeder.
And you got it. And then go get a slinky toy, the old kind.
Yeah.
Fix that to the bottom of the bird feeder. And the pole, of course, would ride up in the middle. And you want to make the slinky so it only goes maybe halfway to the ground. And the squirrel tries to climb up and he bungee jumps.
Ah,
that's.
And I don't know. It has worked real well here. Now I'm supposed my squirrels are going to get smarter and figure out how to get around that. But so far they haven't.
That's a great solution, and like you said, one of the reasons it works so well is similar to the principle with those squirrel-proof bird feeders that have a baffle, and when the squirrel lands on the perch, the weight of the squirrel closes the baffle, and same thing with these slinkies. So that slinky is not strong enough to support the squirrel's weight, and so it can't get up the pole. And it works really, really well as long as the feeder is high enough off the ground that the squirrel can't jump up, and it's also far enough away from roof lines or trees that the squirrel can't jump from an aerial perch down. But that's a great, great suggestion. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Let's go to George in Rockland next. Hey, George, thanks for calling.
Yes, there is a hypothesis on the moose population. They're more adapted for a northern climate, like with their wide feet and stuff. But the parasitic problems have been extremely bad for the moose, especially the winter tick, and they itch themselves to the point where they completely denude themselves of all their fur, and the locals refer to it as a ghost moose. They run around, and you look at them, and they're just like almost pure white.
The ticks and everything.
Yeah, so yeah. It's probably. I'm not familiar with that hypothesis, but you know, certainly, again, it sounds like right now the Minnesota DNR is searching for answers, and that certainly could be a possibility. But you know, that is very similar to like a sarcoptic mange that raccoons or fox sometimes get from. That's from an ectoparasite, the mite. But same type of thing, is essentially the mange just gets so bad that it causes the animal to lose its fur, and once you've lost that fur, especially when it starts getting cold, you have no way to protect yourself thermally, and you can die from hypothermia.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate that call, George. Let's turn to Sue and Madison next. Sue, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. This is Sue B., and I'm a guide at the UW-Madison Arboretum. We currently have on display for anyone who walks in the door at the Arboretum an owl display with several owls from the saw-whet, screech, and great horn, and a couple others, but we don't have a snowy owl. And if the person who has that mounted snowy owl would contact me at the Arboretum at 608-263-7888, we could certainly lovingly put the snowy owl with that collection.
Oh, that's wonderful, Sue. And you gave that number, 608-263-7888. And I know from firsthand experience you do have a nice owl collection out there. And it's just frankly, it's just a beautiful place to go anyway.
It is.
It's just a wonderful place.
You know, and that's really why, you know, some of those, so the caller earlier that had found a snowy owl and wanted, you know, to obtain the permission to be able to keep it, really, it's coming down to getting those to the numerous nature centers, the charter schools, the Green Schools Network. There are so many outlets for and need for these types of specimens for learning that they often will not allow them to go out for personal use. So,
and the person from Minocqua who had the snowy owl, actually, if you don't want to go make the long distance call at 263-7888, you could go online to the Arboretum's website, yep. UW-Madison Arboretum. And Sue, I bet you that person could make contact that way.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. Appreciate the call. The Arboretum, all times of the year, is a wonderful place to visit. It's a great research facility, but it's also just, you know, if you're just an average citizen, you can go and have a wonderful time.
Yep, it is. I am on the Arboretum Policy Committee and go out there quite often. And I'm also on the Search and Screen Committee currently, and we are interviewing beginning next week the first of three candidates that are coming in to interview for the permanent Arboretum Director position.
Oh,
wonderful. And we've got three phenomenal candidates coming in, and all three of them have great visions for long-term use of the Arboretum from education and research standpoint. And so we're really excited to see what's going on. We'll probably have a new Arboretum Director hopefully by middle of summer at the latest.
Wonderful. Let's turn to Claire in Sauk City next. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Larry. I love your show.
Thank you.
Last night I heard two critters fighting in the middle of the night. It was enough to waken me. And I don't think it was cats. My guess is raccoons. And another question, if it is raccoons, can I do something to discourage them from hanging out in my yard without having to, you know, put out 50 boxes of mothballs or something?
Well, Jan, there's a number of animals that it could be. If you do think it was raccoons, and that certainly is a possibility, many animals are starting their early breeding vocalizations, coyotes, fox, animals like that. But raccoons, certainly a good guess, reasonable. You could go online and Google or do a search for raccoons and audio, and you'll come across some of those, and you can make some comparisons and see if indeed that is what you had.
Okay.
As far as, are you in town, Jan?
Yeah, I am.
Okay. So some things to be aware of as far as raccoons go. I mean, they're very highly adaptable to living in human-dominated landscapes. Some things just in terms of your yard. Make sure you have your garbage secured, preferably in a garage or in the home. Don't feed dogs or cats outside or leave their food bowls remaining. Things to not provide attractants for them to come and hang out further. Yeah. If you don't have a chimney cap on your chimney, now's a really good time to put one on there, because that's a potential den site for them. And it is not uncommon for raccoons to den in a chimney, and it becomes a pretty costly endeavor as you have to hire somebody to get it out most of the time. So yeah, just being aware. I mean, they are very adaptable and do quite well in the urban areas.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Jan in Wisconsin Rapids, it's your turn. Hi, Jan.
Hi, Larry. Great show again. I got to tell you, years back, I was cross-country skiing outside of Plover in a cut cornfield headed for a wood line, and I noticed a bump in the snow, skied over to it, and found a red-tailed hawk had dropped out of the sky. Now, there was no marks around the bird. He had dropped right out of the sky. He was stuck in the snow, dead. I pulled him out of the snow, and there was a squirrel rabbit's leg sticking out of its mouth. And one of its claws was off and had been suited up. So the bird had evidently been rescued. They removed the claw from infection, and the bird couldn't cut his rabbit up in small enough pieces and choked on it in midair and fell into this cornfield. And you were talking about mounts. I ended up taking it to the university in Point, and I never found out, but they were going to mount it.
Yeah.
But that's an interesting mount.
So it was sutured. You could tell
it was sutured. As a matter of fact, I had called a vet in Plover who's passed away now, but he admitted that somebody had brought him that bird, and he had an infection, and they had removed the claw, and he sutured it up.
Huh.
And it had a stump for and fresh sutures for one claw.
Interesting. And you're saying that the bird had a part of a rabbit's leg lodged in its throat?
Oh, yeah, it was sticking out of its beak.
Huh, interesting. Well,
the foot was hanging out of its mouth.
Huh. Well, you know, the other thing is...
It died in midair and dropped right out of the sky.
Huh. You know, the other option, it very well could have had some issue with associated with the rabbit, the prey it was eating, but... Birds are also, they have very fast metabolisms and high blood pressure, and so they're very susceptible a lot of times to heart attacks and high blood pressure consequences. So it's not unusual that birds sometimes do have heart issues because of that high blood pressure, and it's possible that the animal just suffered from either maybe it was a natural cause of death also, and it was just unfortunate that as it was flying over that cornfield, it suffered death.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you, Jan. That's an interesting story. And it was amazing that he was able to actually track down
the person
who did the suturing.
No kidding.
Was that cool? Bob in Sun Prairie. Hi there.
Hello.
Yes, hello, Bob. What's on your mind?
The other day I saw a huge owl in our backyard. It must have been at least a foot tall, maybe 5-6 inches wide, and suddenly I was watching it, and the thing zoomed down and killed a rabbit. And I was wondering what kind of owl this could be, and which owls are coniferous and which ones aren't.
Well, was it
it was very large.
Must have been daylight when you saw this.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
It was, probably in mid-afternoon.
Okay. Yep. Well, you know, the two largest owls that would be in Sun Prairie would either be a great horned owl or a barred owl, and the great horned owl would be differentiated from the barred owl because you would see the two tufts of hair or feathers sticking up off the head, like feather horns, and all owls are essentially carnivorous, so they're called birds of prey for a reason, because they all eat. They all eat other animals, primarily rabbits or snakes or small mammals, mice and rats and things like that. So that's a pretty neat thing to see, and it's exciting to be able to watch something like that play out.
Yeah, that's for sure. You get I can remember when the rabbits can really squeal.
They are very
vocal.
Yes,
they can.
Yes.
Very,
especially
very
when bad things are happening to them.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, very vocal. Right. I had a red-tailed hawk take one, and I happened to see that happen. And boy, that that was quite the schooling going. Although if something, you know, proportional size came and grabbed me, I'd probably be screaming on top of my lungs, too. Oh, thanks, Bob. Appreciate it. Lee in Dorchester, Iowa, it's on to you now. Thanks for calling.
Yes, yes. I have a woodpecker problem. I have some cedar siding on my house trim, and I live in a forest out in the country with plenty of trees, but occasionally a woodpecker will prefer my cedar siding to the trees. Do you have any solutions?
Well, Lee, there's a couple of things I'll suggest. And the first thing I'll do is I'm going to direct you to a website that we have. And the website is wildlifedamage.uwex.edu. And that's all one word. So wildlifedamage.uwex.edu. And we've got a fact sheet on that website on woodpecker managing woodpecker damage. So, and there's a variety of woodpeckers that could be doing it. It's it most likely could be a downy woodpecker, for example.
It is. I can, you know, I hear them and I go out. I can see it, you know, and I scare it away, but that doesn't mean it.
So there's a couple of things to do. Is number one, make sure you don't have any food up that's maybe attracting that woodpecker. So take your suet feeders down if you've got that. On the areas where the damage is occurring, you may want to have a pest control company or an exterminator come out and inspect that area and see if you have insect infestation in that area of the damage. And so even though the front of the board or the face of the board that you're looking at may look solid, that on the backside, maybe you get some water damage or some rot from the outside or from the inside out, and the insects are taking advantage of that. So if that's the case, the exterminator should then treat that area and get rid of the food source, which should reduce or hopefully eliminate the woodpecker damage. And at that point, then you can go and replace the damaged boards. The other option is, you know, there's a lot of very attractive non-wood options for siding and things like that, and I'm thinking about cement board is one of those that
that isn't the trim, it is the cement board.
Yep.
So I have started maybe, you know, replacing
yep.
some of the trim with that, but I have an awful lot of it. So
yeah, and so that's, you know, maybe you should start replacing boards. Think about replacing with cement board that would kind of match that cedar, natural cedar. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the options. The other thing you can do is get Mylar tape, or you can get strips of aluminum foil, and you would hang that in the area where the damage is occurring, and typically that will keep the woodpeckers off there. But those are some of the things that we've featured in this fact sheet on woodpecker damage, and again, if you go to our website, you can download that, and there's also information where you can find contact information for either myself or Jamie, and we'd be glad to help you off air, too.
All right.
Okay. Wildlife damage.
.uwex.edu.
Oh, another dot in there.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
Why not? Dots
Thanks,
are free.
Lee. Thanks, Lee.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Wow, lots of things we covered. You know, we didn't. Here we got about not even a minute here. But what about white nose syndrome in our bats? We're looking for it again. Anything to report?
Well, they've been monitoring for white nose syndrome the last 4 years and have not detected the fungus.
Nope, thankfully.
In Wisconsin, thankfully. Yeah. So we do have one of the very best teams of bat ecologists.
Yep, absolutely.
And they have just been extremely proactive in terms of looking, researching, monitoring our state bats. So if anybody does see unusual bat behavior, like finding dead bats, in the upcoming months, or observing a bat flying around outside, please do let us let the Department of Natural Resources know. But that monitoring is continuing, and at this point, it is all good news.
Thanks,
guys.
Keep your fingers crossed.
Yeah, thanks. We'll look forward to your next visit. Thank you so much. David Drake and Jamie Nack, our guests from the UW-Madison and UW Extension, are great to have them with us, and they definitely will be back. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.